MSO News, giving voice to the North Shore. This is North Shore Today for Monday, January 29, 2024, brought to you by Moynihan Lumber. Moynihan Lumber supporting local news coverage and communities on the North Shore. I'm Rick Moore. In today's news, Gloucester 400 Plus continues this month with an event this week. A Newburyport policeman is credited with saving a man's life, and we have an update on the arrest of a Saugus middle school teacher.
I'm Bill Newell, and later in sports, we'll be wrestling with a few local sports stories. Rick?
All right, I get it. Thanks, Bill. Cloudy, windy, mid to upper 30s today. High tide, Gloucester Harbor, 1:29 p.m. The Gloucester 400 Plus Committee will be ending its year-long commemoration this month. One highlight coming this month is the launching of the Gloucester Lyceum and Sawyer Free Library's Gloucester Timeline, an interactive history online research tool. Ethan Foreman writes in the Gloucester Times that the research center will be located at the renovated library when it opens on Dale Avenue in 2025. An event this Wednesday at the ballroom at the Beauport Hotel on Commercial Street will feature community storytellers, an interactive Gloucester trivia game, and a demonstration of the library's new interactive timeline. We have a link up on this post to the online timeline. The Wednesday event is free to the public. It runs from 6:30 to 8, and speakers will begin at 7. Through a community partnership, the Lynn Mayor's office will hold a mentorship spotlight and recruitment event tonight to connect residents with programs available in the city. This is Lynn Mayor Jared Nicholson.
We're going to be hosting a mentorship spotlight and recruitment event right here in City Hall to connect residents with programs available in the city that provide youth support and mentoring, as well as recruit residents to become mentors for our community's youth. Residents of any age that are interested in becoming mentors and forming empowering relationships with our young people through guidance, influence, and their own example are encouraged to attend and sign up for a mentorship program.
The mentoring event is today from 5 to 7 p.m. at City Hall. We have an update on last week's story involving the arrest of a Saugus Middle School science teacher. The Daily Item reports that it was surveillance video showing the teacher, Roxanne Plaxson, leaving a bathroom where a powdery substance was found that directed the police investigation. Police determined that after speaking with Plaxson, they recovered a bottle containing a powdery substance that was later determined to be approximately 6 grams of fentanyl. Plaxson was charged with a misdemeanor of possession of a Class A drug. The Newton teacher strike continues today, and today will mark the seventh day without school for Newton students. The Cape Ann Climate Coalition is sponsoring a webinar with State Senate Minority Leader Bruce Tarr of Gloucester tomorrow from 5 to 6 p.m. The Gloucester Times reports that Tarr will describe major climate actions and initiatives at the state level. We have a link on this post to the Cape Ann Climate Coalition website, where there is a Zoom link to the online event. The Daily News in Newburyport has a feature story today noting how an off-duty Newburyport police officer, Sergeant Jason Cohen, saved the life of a skater at an early morning pickup hockey game at the Graff Rink. Jim Sullivan writes that 63-year-old Mark Callahan, one of the skaters with Cohen that day, became short of breath. Cohen led the CPR effort, and as Callahan says in the story, he saved my life. There's much more in today's Newburyport Daily News. The projected cost of replacing the HVAC system at the Beverly Public Library has risen from just over $3 million to more than $18 million in fewer than 2 years. Salem News reporter Paul Layton on what he has found.
Yeah, it's a little unusual. Like, you hear this all the time about, well, the original cost of this project was so-and-so, and then by the time they get to it a year or two later, it's gone up a lot, which is perfectly understandable, and with inflation and supply chain problems in the wake of the pandemic and all that. So that's all sort of almost standard stuff. But in this case, the two numbers are $3.7 million that was presented to the city council a couple of years ago, and the current price tag of $18 million, so 3.7 to 18. And so anyway, I've been getting into this a little bit, and councilors have a lot of questions. They need to approve this project, approve the borrowing of the money. But it's basically, when the city first presented it, Mayor Cahill and his staff a couple of years ago, they didn't include a lot of costs that, presumably, they didn't know the exact amount, but they didn't give the full scope of the project. I guess the question is why they didn't do that. They said that, well, this 3.7 number was provided by a consultant who was only considering, you know, the construction costs and not this and that and the other thing. But anyway, it's just the fact that it's gone up that much. What they want to do, this is at the Beverly Public Library, they want to put in a geothermal, you know, heating system to replace the failing HVAC system in the library. And geothermal is kind of interesting. It's the, you know, it's the environmental friendly technique, no fossil fuels. They put the pipes, you know, 200 feet underground or something like that and take advantage of the Earth's heat. Beverly did it at their new police station a few years ago. And that's the first time they've done it, and they want to do it at the library too. So, and in the long term, it's supposed to save on energy costs quite a bit, and also reduce the carbon footprint of the city. So it's not just the cost of the project that's interesting, but also the type of project too.
That's Salem News reporter Paul Layton. Sports is next with Bill Newell, and then stay with us for North Shore Today Extra as we go back into the newsroom and hear from Salem News reporters Paul Layton and Dustin Luca.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. Yes, we are a full-service lumber yard, but we also offer doors and windows and kitchen cabinets. Please visit us in Beverly, North Reading, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
If you're a soap bar user and you're always annoyed by the fact that when you use your entire bar, you're stuck with this little sliver of soap that you don't know what to do with, hold on, because I think I have the solution for you. It's always a pain to have that little sliver of soap that we didn't really know how to use but didn't want to waste and throw away. So we invented this cute, cube-shaped soap bar that then you can place your old little soap sliver right into. There's a carved-out X in the center of the bar that then you can place your old soap sliver into. You just break up that little sliver into pieces that are two or three, and it fits right inside. And bam, now you've got a brand new soap bar and you didn't have to waste anything. If that's something you're interested in and you want to support a sustainable small business, then head on over to our shop at exobath.com. You can buy one for yourself or give it as a gift. It ships anywhere in the United States, and you can get 20% off your first order.
Click on to the Exobath banner at the top of our website. This is MSO Sports, bringing voice to the North Shore. The Celtics were off yesterday. They'll host the New Orleans Pelicans tonight at the Garden, tip off at 7:30. The Bruins are off this week, an extended all-star break for the Bruins. This year's Super Bowl will feature the Chiefs versus the 49ers. The game is just under 2 weeks away, a week from this coming Sunday. The Northeastern Conference and Cape Ann League held their joint wrestling meet in Gloucester on Saturday. The event was won by Beverly High, followed by Gloucester, the Saugus Peabody team, the Marblehead Swampscott team, Triton, then North Reading Linfield team, Pentucket, Salem, the Masco Essex Tech team, and then Danvers. Over the weekend, Salem High honored the 1990 Salem Boys State Championship basketball team. We have two posts up on our website on that event. As for the Friday game, Salem beat Marblehead for the second time this season. Salem coach Tom Doyle.
Great game tonight, both teams, hard-fought victory, back and forth all game. We were able to play a nice third quarter, give us a little cushion, and then respond to their run in the fourth quarter. Very proud of these guys.
The North Reading boys basketball team, although under 500 this season, have won three out of their last four games. This is North Reading coach Joe Casey.
Yeah, no, we sort of knew going into this season that it was going to take us a while to get this going. And you know, we're playing better, Bill. Like you said, we've won three out of our last four. Our younger kids are starting to grow, getting a little bit more confident. So we're happy where we are. We've got a big stretch of games. You know, we're playing some meaningful games, you know, coming into February, which is exactly where we wanted to be.
Casey spoke with MSO Sports yesterday about his team and the Cape Ann League and their game tonight in Ipswich.
There's a middle that we find ourselves a part of. Our game at Ipswich tonight has tournament implications for both of us. We're both 5-8. We're both looking for a win. You know, teams like Pentucket, teams like Amesbury, all in that middle. So, as usual, the Cape Ann League is competitive.
North Reading boys basketball coach Joe Casey. This is North Shore Today, giving voice to the North Shore, the area's only daily news and sports podcast. Along with Rick Moore, I'm Bill Newell. Have a great Monday, everybody. Don't forget, North Shore Today Extra is next with the Salem News reporters.
If you're a soap bar user and you're always annoyed by the fact that when you use your entire bar, you're stuck with this little sliver of soap that you don't know what to do with, hold on, because I think I have the solution for you. It's always a pain to have that little sliver of soap that we didn't really know how to use but didn't want to waste and throw away. So we invented this cute cube-shaped soap bar that then you can place your old little soap sliver right into. There's a carved out X in the center of the bar that then you can place your old soap sliver into. You just break up that little sliver into pieces that are two or three and it fits right inside. And bam, now you've got a brand new soap bar and you didn't have to waste anything. If that's something you're interested in and you want to support a sustainable small business, then head on over to our shop at exobath.com. You can buy one for yourself or give it as a gift. It ships anywhere in the United States and you can get 20% off your first order.
Click on to the Exobath banner at the top of our website.
Welcome to From the Newsroom with Salem News journalist Paul Layton and Dustin Luca. Paul, Dustin, how are you guys doing? Start with
Dustin. Howdy,
howdy. Oh, okay.
Hey, Rick.
Very good, very good. I always get these things messed up when I... Bill Noah's got to show me how to do this. Anyway, the idea of this is to talk with the news writers, to you guys, about stories that you have done or are working on, and just your thoughts as how to the, you know, they're relevant to our community. And, Paul, I'd like to start with you. You wrote a very poignant story, I think, on David Shribman. And I think most of us on Cape Ann and on the North Shore are familiar with David Shribman as an opinion writer for the papers. But tell me a little bit about the background and that story on David.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Rick. Yeah, David Shribman spoke the other night at North Shore Community College. They have an annual event, a forum on tolerance, and they invited him to speak. So Shribman is a guy, longtime newspaper person, and you know, we were interested because he's a local guy. He grew up in Swampscott. He's he started at the Salem News when he was a teenager back in the day. And but he was speaking mostly on the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh a few years back. And because he's lived in Pittsburgh for 20 years with his family. He was the editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette for that time period for 20 years. And at the time of the shooting, he lives three blocks from that synagogue. So he talked about what it was like to, he's Jewish, and what it was like to be a part of that community and also have to cover the story. So, and the impact that that's had on him in the community. So I thought it was an interesting talk. He said how, and you know, Dustin would know, and anybody who's a reporter knows, like, it, your first instinct on these things as a reporter is, well, that you have a job to do, you know. So he, you know, he went right into work, and the place was already filled with reporters who knew that they had to, you know, write the story. And so anyway, he talked about that a lot, which I thought, you know, was really interesting. And he said it sort of marked this new era, and not a good one for, you know, for Jewish people in the United States, and the rising anti-Semitism. And he said that, you know, American Jews walk, they're more fearful when they walk the streets now, unfortunately. And he said, of course, it's nothing new in history, and it sort of ebbs and flows, he said, but that's, that was really devastating. That section of Pittsburgh is, that he said that Pittsburgh has the largest Jewish population of any major city in the country too. And there are, I think, 11 synagogues within like a mile of where he lives. So really had an impact, and he gave a really nice talk about it.
My wife and I just recently had a talk about what's going on, you know, especially in the Middle East and so on. And, you know, as a semi-educated person, knowing that this tribalism has been going on for thousands of years, but it just seems like of all the so-called religions or races the planet has seen, the war against Judaism, it just continues. It's insane, and I don't understand it. So that must have been a very emotional talk. And I want to ask you, Paul, following up, and Dustin also, you mentioned covering stories, and Dustin and I were talking about veterans, combat veterans, or just veterans who haven't even seen combat, and how you sleep at night and things like that. And for reporters, I know I had to cover once. I didn't have to. That's the difference between what I do and what you do. I did cover an accident, a fatal accident involving a friend. And most of the time, I won't do it. I can't. I don't have the ability to compartmentalize or whatever it is you do that you do. So I wonder if you could just take a moment, each of you, and I'll start with Paul. The difficulty, the personal emotion in doing a story, whatever it might be, because you have feelings and you live in the community, and both of you know many of the people that you're covering. So, Paul? Mm.
No, I appreciate you asking that question, Rick, and I think you said the key word is the compartmentalization. I guess that's what we do. And, you know, I never really even thought about it that much over the years, which is probably one way of protecting yourself. You know, it's just, that's just what you train to do, and you do it, and you have to get the story done. But there has been more of an emphasis on the mental health of reporters, along with newspaper reporters, on the mental health of everybody else in the country. Just reading on these, you know, journalism websites, and that you know, people need to take that into account more in the impact. So it is hard because, you know, like you said, I think it's especially hard for local reporters. I mean, I've covered situations where you show up and you know the people, you know, who've been impacted. You know, I cover Beverly where I grew up and still live, you know, but so, yeah, I don't know if there's a great answer. I mean, I have thought about that more and wondered what the impact has been, say, on myself and my mental health. I don't know what the answer is. I think I'm doing okay, but I think it is, and I appreciate you asking the question, because I think it is, like any, you know, the topic of mental health, it's just good to talk about it more. It's something I've been doing this for 40 years now, and nobody talked about it at the beginning, and at least people talk about it now, which is very helpful.
I appreciate your sharing, Dustin.
Yeah, and one of the things that I've found, because, I mean, covering things can always be very challenging for a reporter, especially if you're, you know, coming upon a fire scene where you're talking to somebody who's literally losing everything in their lives. It's, and, you know, sometimes you might find yourself on a path where you actually have to try to talk to that person and try to get a soundbite from them that you then put into a story. There's been other times where I've, like, I covered court cases where it's really difficult to try to hear some of the details that come out of them. There's a lot of things that we hear that don't actually make the stories. And sometimes getting through it is just kind of reminding yourself that, you know, we're being paid not so much to feel something, but to present to society what's going on in society. And, you know, for me, to Paul's point about compartmentalizing the feelings, oftentimes I kind of, you know, pocket them until the end of the day, like covering, I think it was the, there was a trial that I had to cover in the last couple of years that involved a food delivery driver that was, you know, basically shot in the head. And that was really difficult for me to cover because I'm also, you know, I side gig as a food delivery driver, and I kind of put myself in that position initially. Like, you know, I drive by Athus Roast Beef and I go, okay, that's where that happened. Could I encounter something like that? And I keep saying, you know, this isn't me. I'm a different person, and I compartmentalize. And that's kind of how I process all of it. So, you know, we're kind of in a position where we have to see these things kind of for the good of society, so society understands what's going on. And, you know, we do have some access to tools, and some of them is self-guided, self-developed tools to kind of get through that, right, at the end of the day. But it's, you know, we all have something that we do.
Well, I think one of the things that I've learned over the years is that physical pain, you forget the physical pain. You know, if I ask you both right now, hurt like you did when you broke your arm or whatever, you can't do it. But emotional pain just doesn't go away. And you if you think about it, the hurt comes right back again, or what, maybe, you know, whatever it is that you've seen or had to do. So thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that.
And it's worth also noting, too, that physical and emotional pain are both processed by the same part of the brain. So they're both handled internally the same way.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that. I'm gonna have to read up on that now. See, you got me wanting to learn more. I appreciate it. All right, Dustin, a story that you've been covering, maybe they kind of go hand in hand, but politics in Salem, it's never quiet. Something to do with the election commission, something to do with home rule. Maybe you can put the pieces together for me.
Yeah, so basically there's a couple of different things going on in Salem, and the home rule petition thing is a really big deal right now. And it's a really big deal that's really difficult to explain because there's nothing sexier than the three words home, rule, and petition put directly. You know, the only thing that's better than that is zoning, right? So,
but what's
going on in Salem is that there's a number of changes that they keep trying to make that they can't make at their own level. The changes are too significant for them to make. They need to get the state to review it and to sign off on it. And that's done through a home rule petition to the state legislature. And there are some very sizable things that Salem has moved forward in recent years that go to the state legislature and then basically stay there and then expire at the end of the session, having never been touched. This keeps happening on a couple of different matters in Salem. So they keep having to submit the same petitions over and over again. And it's kind of reaching a critical point now because it's there's a really great example of one home rule petition that's actually hurting the city. They in the past couple of years have made a number of attempts at tackling the condo conversion crisis in Salem, where people are basically buying up 2 and 3 family properties with cash and then converting them into condos. And with that, you're losing all these apartments left and right. There's entire streets of apartments that are now gone because of this. So the city launched a condo conversion ordinance to stop it. And they need to get the state legislature to approve it. And that's not happening. And as the city is waiting for this to happen, apartments are continuing to disappear from the market. Rents are now doing this even further because there's less apartments. And people are coming in and kind of swooping up and grabbing these condos left and right. So it's in this one example of a home rule petition that's not getting approved, you see a city that is losing control of the housing crisis through no fault of its own. So that's kind of one big thing. And that's why there's been so much coverage that I've been throwing to home rule petitions, just to basically spotlight that this is a real crisis in Salem. And the way that comes into an election commission is because the city is looking at changing up the way it handles its elections. Right now it's done in the city clerk's office, which also does birth certificates, deaths, weddings. There's like 10,000 different things that they do. And when they have to run an election, all of those other things basically take a back seat. So then with that, when that happens, the process to complete paperwork for city council meetings doesn't happen as quickly. People wait longer to get their birth certificates and things like that. So what they're looking at doing, which is of course going to rely on the state legislature, is to move the entire elections process to an actual department known as an elections commission. Now, a number of towns and cities have done this. And the reason why Andy Varela in Ward 7 on the city council here is looking to explore this is because there's a couple of spots in Salem that have historically, you know, anemic turnout at the polls. And the thinking is if you no longer have the city clerk who's already doing 10,000, well, really 9,999 other jobs, and you give it to one person whose sole job is to focus on elections, then you might get better than 4% turnout in the point. So that's kind of what they're looking at. It's going to take at least a year to play out. It's going to require charter change. It's going to require state approval. So we don't know where it's going to go. But that's kind of where both of those things are right now.
Well, anecdotally, what's the feeling about that in terms of support in the city?
Oh, what, the election commission?
Yeah.
People love the idea. In fact, when the city council was talking about it, I think I heard 3 councilors say that the present city clerk endorses the idea. So I haven't had a chance to talk to Eileen Simons specifically, but a lot of people are saying that Eileen Simons is in support of this. So, like, which is basically somebody saying, please take this off my plate. So,
yeah, really. Yeah, well, that makes sense. Well, I want to go back to Beverly. Bill Newell and I were incredulous at a story that you wrote about library costs going up like 5 million% or something or other. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a little unusual. Like you hear this all the time about, well, the original cost of this project was so-and-so, and then by the time they get to it a year or two later, it's gone up a lot, which is perfectly understandable. And with inflation and supply chain problems in the wake of the pandemic and all that. So that's all sort of almost standard stuff. But in this case, the two numbers are $3.7 million that was presented to the city council a couple of years ago and the current price tag of $18 million. So 3.7 to 18. And so anyway, I've been getting into this a little bit and councilors have a lot of questions. They need to approve this project, approve the borrowing of the money. But it's basically when the city first presented it, Mayor Cahill and his staff a couple of years ago, they didn't include a lot of costs. They didn't know the exact amount, but they didn't give the full scope of the project. I guess the question is why they didn't do that. They said that, well, this 3.7 number was provided by a consultant who was only considering, you know, the construction costs and not this and that and the other thing. But anyway, it's just the fact that it's gone up that much. What they want to do, this is at the Beverly Public Library, they want to put in a geothermal, you know, heating system to replace the failing HVAC system in the library. And geothermal is kind of interesting. It's the, you know, it's the environmental friendly technique, no fossil fuels. They put the pipes, you know, 200 feet underground or something like that and take advantage of the Earth's heat. Beverly did it at their new police station a few years ago. And that's the first time they've done it. And they want to do it at the library too. So, and in the long term, it's supposed to save on energy costs quite a bit and also reduce the carbon footprint of the city. So it's not just the cost of the project that's interesting, but also the type of project too.
Is there a prediction as to how this will affect the taxpayer if this goes through?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the immediate question is, will it pass? And it's because in Beverly, usually the city council is pretty aligned with the Cahill administration. There's not a lot of controversy on these things sometimes. And this one might be a little different. This needs this loan order for the city to borrow this money. The council needs to vote. 2/3 of the council needs to vote in favor. So I don't know if that's going to happen. And I can't remember the last time that the city council shot down a proposal, you know, for the mayor. So we'll have to see what happens.
All right. We'll have to keep buying the newspaper. All right. Justin, I know that we're in a time constraint here. What else might you like to mention about your coverage and your work?
Well, I know the big thing that we had going on recently is storm damage. Salem got absolutely wrecked by the recent storm, specifically the one last Saturday. In fact, it actually cut off access for the second time in 4 days to the Willows. So, and that got really scary because I was actually down there for it. I was able to get to the Willows just before the peak of the flooding hit. And then I got a chance to actually see and kind of cover the aftermath, the recovery of the Willows. They had a seawall go down. The ocean just flat out went over another seawall that they've been talking about replacing. So it was kind of a terrifying moment down there, especially where they had 4 separate fire incidents that they couldn't get fire trucks to because there was no way to get into the Willows. So this has all put a really big spotlight on the city's infrastructure, especially where we've been talking about it, doing so many stories on it already. Now to have the Willows go from being stranded in 2018, and then the next incident was in 2022, 4 years later, and then the next incident was 1 year later, and then the next incident was 4 days later. It clearly there's a pattern here, and it's the city's kind of in a position now where I think the issue has gotten ahead of them, especially where you see the ocean just literally top a seawall. People just couldn't believe that. South and North River both crested. There was a homeless encampment, or there still is a homeless encampment on the South River that literally just had the river just come up on it during the storm, which has never happened before from what I was told. So that's kind of where things stand on all that. I know still doing a lot of stories on kind of the initial reactions to those storms. And I know the Willows Flood Control Advisory Committee is going to be meeting, I think, February 9th, I think, is their next meeting. I know it's early February. I saw an agenda for it yesterday, and it's probably going to be a hell of a meeting because they've been for years trying to basically say we need to get the seawall taken care of. And, you know, it's the ocean was literally touching, you know, front steps for the first time a couple weekends ago. So